Well, welcome to the 9th annual MBA State of the Economy Forum. This is the forum where once a year we ask the age-old question, can economists agree on anything? So we will be asking that among other questions. I'm Tim Cook, a 1995 undergraduate of the business school and a 2005 graduate of the technology management MBA program. I guess it took me 10 years to realize I hadn't learned everything I needed to know. It's my pleasure to facilitate tonight's event, and I want to let you know that this event is brought to you by the Foster School of Business, as well as the University of Washington Alumni Association. A little plug reminding you to become members of the Alumni Association if you haven't. I'd like to start off with somewhat of an absurd act of redundancy, because most of you already know our two distinguished panels, but even though they need no introduction, first off, I'd like to introduce the monarch of monetary policy, the princess of Pacific Rim economics, Karma Hadjimichalekis. Karma is a principal lecturer in business economics and finance and the Everett McCabe Faculty Fellow at the Foster School. And her specialties include, as I just mentioned, monetary policy and banking, financial markets, domestic and international macroeconomics, and Pacific Rim economics. Karma has been at the University of Washington for 40 years. Now, is that true, Karma? So for all of you who have been wondering about the rumor, it's true. She was born in Balmer Hall. Now, Ed, I'm sorry, your name just isn't as fun to pronounce as Karma Hadjimichalekis, so you won't get that roaring applause. But Ed is the Associate Professor of Finance and Business Economics at the Foster School, and he specializes in corporate control, not to be mixed up with controlling corporations. That's not your specialty. General corporate finance and applied microeconomics. Ed's just a pup here at the University of Washington, having only served here for 31 years. Give it up for Ed. Now, many of you submitted some questions for tonight's panel. Well, we'll probably just go ahead and make up our own this evening. The panelists, will you come out from your corners swinging? Oh, and just to clarify, these are the questions that you submitted, unless there's a particularly brilliant one, in which case. Now, if common sense, or I guess we should say economic theory, dictates that in an economic crisis, it's a bad thing to raise taxes, what is our state government thinking right now, and is Chris Gregoire refusing to take your phone calls these days? Can you explain?
Thanks, Tim. Yeah. And thanks, everyone, for coming. It's really nice to be able to reconnect with you. And actually, I have changed the question just a little bit.
Last minute notice. Like I said, throw them away.
So I would just rephrase the statement that says, if common sense says that raising taxes and cutting spending is the wrong thing to do, why is our state raising taxes and cutting spending, for example, to bring it home on higher education? And why is this the wrong thing to do? Because raising taxes and cutting spending in a downturn, we know, aggravates the downturn. And there's a reason, however, that we have to do that, and that is that states have balanced budget rules. So what happens in a recession is that incomes fall and taxes fall, and so budget deficits emerge. And since they're not allowed to run budget deficits, then they have to cut back. And so I think there is some judgment about comparing the effects of cutting spending versus raising taxes. Certainly, we started by cutting spending. But then there is the issue, what's the trade-off, for instance, in terms of higher education? How much do you want to eat your seed corn and deplete your human capital. So I think that's the decision that they made, that they had made a lot of hard choices in cutting spending and therefore chose to raise taxes. So there's a second part of this question, which says, what is the proper role of government as it relates to business? And I'm only going to mention one thing, and that is one role of the government is to deal with market failures. And an example would be what we economists call externalities, negative side effects of decisions that firms and households make. And one example is pollution. So the reason I mention this is to try to connect the issue of raising taxes and increasing efficiency. So what do I think they should do? Well, one thing I think would be good is to raise gas taxes, because that would reduce pollution and increase efficiency. Of course, I'm a teacher, not a politician, so nobody would vote for me, but fortunately, I don't want to be a politician.
Ed?
Well, I want to start with thanking all of you for coming, especially the ones who've had me in class. And especially the ones who've had me for two classes. Some of you have had me for two classes. Some others of you have had me for three classes, which means I guess you really didn't get it in the first three classes. But it is a huge compliment to have all of you show up for something like this and to hear Karma and me, although I know you're mostly here for Karma. So the first thing I would say about advising the governor on what to do is, actually, the governor asked for advice on what to do from some people in the state, including Mark Emmert, the late president of the University of Washington. And Karma and I were among the people asked to instruct Mark Emmert on what to tell Governor Gregoire. And I told her all the things to do, like don't raise taxes and cut spending and increase user fees instead of taxes, and spend on infrastructure where it's sensible and where it's low cost at the moment. And she ignored all that advice, as far as I can tell. I don't know if Mark Emmert even told her the advice I gave her, which is maybe why he's leaving the university. I don't know. But I think there's a more important reason why she didn't listen to us, and that's because while we were talking, there are also all these lobbyists talking that have a lot more money than we do, and they have a lot more power in what actually goes on. Economists are mostly people who give excuses for what people want to do anyway. The second thing I would say on the role of government, there are a few roles of government. My view of government is government has a very limited role relative to what most people think. But I agree with Karma. One of the roles of government is to control externalities, negative externalities, by taxing them, by changing incentives so that the appropriate amount of these negative effects is realized. I think another role of government is enforcement of property rights and enforcement of the rule of law. By far, the most important thing to generating economic well-being is the rule of law, enforcing the rule of law. Across countries, within countries, I don't care what. If you have people being bribed people and no sort of government entity, you will never have strong economic growth and improvement in the economic well-being of people. And I think the role of government is also to minimize distortions from the taxes that are necessary to fund the things that they're funding. I am not sure that this is what the government is doing now in the state or in the nation, but these are the sorts of things that I would advocate for a government role.
Thank you, both of you. I should also mention that there will be a Q&A session. We'll break a little bit early from the planned questions, so store up those questions or rebuttals you might have. This is about a discussion. Going from local to global, there's plenty of economic news for us to talk about. People were wondering from the questions that we received, for a better understanding of China and Europe's economics and how they're affecting the world and us, namely, and in particular, what's happening in Greece and how that's going to affect Europe and the U.S. And then a follow-on question to that, does this challenge the U.S.'s economic leadership? Irma?
Well, I'm going to limit my comments to Europe because so much has been happening there, and it's changing day by day. So every day as I thought about this, my answers changed. So maybe tomorrow I'd tell you something else, but this is what I have to say for today. First of all, if we go back to just last week, last Friday, U.S. policymakers were expressing their concern that European policymakers were behind the curve, and they hadn't been able to isolate the problems just to Greece, to ring-fence Greece, which has a huge budget deficit and is having very great difficulty financing it. It is on the verge of default. So after a lot of sort of dithering, they did come up with initially what seemed like a huge package for Greece, $140 billion of loans, which would give the Greek government some breathing space. Because they wouldn't have to go into the markets to fund their deficit. So it would give them some breathing space to do some of the hard things that they have to do. And also, it's not just the Greek government which had difficulty, but if the Greek government defaults, then there are banks throughout Europe, in Germany and France, that hold the debt of the Greek government that now are going to suffer losses. But all this did not calm the markets, and we saw last week the contagion into Portugal and into Spain, where interest rates rose there. And, you know, Spain is very different from Greece because, well, for one thing, Spain's a much bigger economy, so concerns there are bigger for the Eurozone. But before this crisis, Spain had a budget surplus. It's the recession that brought on the budget deficit. And then we saw the effects back in the U.S., and there was a flight to quality into U.S. Treasury securities. So last week we saw interest rates on Treasury securities fall. We saw the dollar rise and the increase in risk aversion. So the stock market fell. And I think sort of the major fear was, you know, are we going to have, this time coming from Europe, another sort of post-Lehman type situation where banks stop trusting each other and the banking sector kind of seizes up. And that's really, I think, what was the catalyst for this dramatic, surprising action by European officials. Another Sunday night solution, but this time it was by Europe and not by the U.S. So if we look at their package, there's a $1 trillion package of loan guarantees. $300 billion of it coming from the IMF, and especially the IMF money. We know that money will be there. What surprised me even more was that the European Central Bank did something it said it would never do, go into the markets and buy government bonds. So it's been in the past few days buying Greek bonds and buying Spanish bonds and buying Italian bonds. And this kind of mimics the whatever it takes policy that the Fed pursued in buying treasury bonds and in buying mortgage-backed securities. So is all this going to work? Well, I think hopefully it's going to stem the contagion. It's going to sort of prevent a global downturn just as we were beginning to see a recovery. And I think that's really the aim of it. But the underlying issues aren't going to go away. And those have to be dealt with. So this aid comes with austerity. Greece and Spain and Portugal, they're going to have massive fiscal contractions. They're going to have to reduce their wages, reduce their prices. They're going to have a deflation. They're going to have a recession. The most important thing for them will be, can they increase their productivity? Because that will be the key to helping them out of this crisis. And until now, you know, Germany has been the high savings country. It's been the country with the trade surpluses. It's been the country that have been exporting to Southern Europe and lending to them. But now Southern Europe has to become more like Germany. But that means Germany has to become less like itself because somebody has got to spend. Okay, so Germany is going to have to rely more on domestic demand than on exports to Southern Europe, or at least exports to somewhere else. So I don't know. a couple years down the road what the situation will look like. But if these readjustments don't all work out, I wouldn't be surprised. And I never thought I would actually say this, but now I wouldn't be surprised if some countries like Greece and maybe Portugal and others don't exit from the Eurozone, thinking that, you know, the one-size-fits-all monetary policy and the one-size exchange rate don't work. So it'll be a couple years before I think we know how this is all going to work out. But this action did, I think, prevent the Eurozone from collapsing.
So I want to summarize what Karma said in just a couple of words, which is, Europe is a mess. Europe is just a huge mess. So I was just at this conference. Now, before I talk more about the conference, I went to this conference just so I could drop it into this particular event. So I'm going to use it regardless if it's relevant, not relevant. I was at a conference with Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan and Phil Graham and all these other people who are almost as famous as I am. And one of the things that what I find useful, often the most fun of these conferences is I sit next to somebody who I absolutely don't know at all and don't have any idea what they do. And I talk to them, and sometimes they tell me things. And one of the people I sat next to at this conference was a guy who's a hedge fund advisor, which is kind of a curious position to begin with. He's a hedge fund advisor, and he's from the UK. He's now living in New York. And one of the things he was telling me is, you know, if you think Greece is in trouble, you ought to look at the UK. You look at sort of the ratios people commonly use for sort of fiscal stability, and they're worse in the UK than they are in Greece. The UK is just a total mess. There's absolutely no prospect of any government that's likely to come out of this new, you know, negotiation between the three parties that they just had an election over there. It says there's nothing on the horizon that can solve this at all. I think in general, you know, what Karma talked about is sort of this bailout package, or whatever you want to call it. Bailout is probably not the word, but this stimulus package, we'll call it, that they just announced over the weekend, is probably going to stop a short-run crisis, but it leaves the long-run situation probably worse. You know, now we have huge moral hazard. Greece has shown you can just sort of spend willy-nilly, have a huge public sector where people aren't doing anything, and you can depend on countries like Germany to come to your rescue when all heck runs amok. So I think, you know, the effect of this, the fact that the European Central Bank is doing things that they were never chartered to do, that they basically are explicitly almost prohibited from doing, suggests that this euro currency zone, as Karma said, is likely to fracture over the next several years. It just looks like a mess. So as far as leadership in the world, I think this reduces the possibility of the euro being used as a reserve currency. European leadership is less likely. But my main comment about leadership in the world, which I'm glad Karma didn't address, she probably would have said exactly the same thing, is, you know, there's a famous article that used to be on my door from Herbert Stein where he says, who's number one? Who cares? That's my view of leadership in the world. I don't care who the leaders are in the world. I just care that we're doing well. And in fact, I kind of care that the other countries are doing well. I'd like to see Greece doing well. I know some Greek people. They're very nice people. I got nothing against Greek people. I'd like to see, you know, British people doing well. I'd like to see Russians doing well, Chinese. I like all kinds of people. And the idea that the, you know, if we make them do worse, we should feel better about ourselves is so counter to every fiber of my being. I almost self-immolate at the thought of it.
Can we take a moment to all hold hands? Well, we've got a mess in Europe, but we also have a mess here at home. one question that was pervasive is credit default swaps. Okay, so we realize that maybe some of you never knew what credit default swaps were or forgot. So we thought, you know, a visual aid might help simplify things. So the calculation for this, no? Thank you. Well, a credit default swap in its more simple terms is somebody buying almost an insurance policy against, say, a bond, some sort of asset. A problem arises, however, when sometimes you don't even have to own that underlying asset and you can hedge against it. And that's where some of these issues came in. I'll read verbatim. It's a very entertaining question that came in. Various sources cite that there were upwards of $10 in credit default swaps contracts for every $1 in underlying assets. By law, I can't buy an insurance policy on Karma or Ed. When should an entity be allowed to buy insurance on an asset that it doesn't own? If my $100,000 house burned to the ground, hang on, we need to just find out where this guy's buying a $100,000 house, first of all. Las Vegas, good. If my $100,000 house burned to the ground and 10 people were allowed to own fire policies on my house, the insurer would be out $1 million and there would be 9 people rushing to the gas station to buy cans of gasoline. This is the state of the credit default swap market. If default swaps were called insurance, they would be regulated appropriately, word for word, but a smelly CDS fish by any other name is still a smelly CDS fish. The question, should credit default swaps be allowed to be purchased by entities or people who do not own the underlying asset? If so, should we regulate who can sell them? For example, who can be the insurer? Ed?
Okay, so my first reaction to this question is somebody's really angry at credit default swaps. And, you know, I'm really sorry if you got swapped or unswapped or something like that. But so there are a couple of things. So this answer is going to be kind of technical, probably inappropriate for this, but they're not going to take me off the stage, so you know, I can continue. First of all, the idea that there are $10 per dollar risk outstanding is a little misleading, because a lot of this $10 is companies who have canceled their previous contracts. So you know, if I buy a credit default swap from somebody and then I sell it to somebody else, because of the nature of the credit default swap market, there's no central clearinghouse, so that shows up as two contracts that are outstanding when, in fact, there's only one contract outstanding. And so this 10 per dollar it's sort of what they call it, the notional amount outstanding, which is biased high. Having said that, let's talk about this. What if you have 9 times the contracts out, so now you have $1 million of insurance on a $100,000 house? What this doesn't point out is the original insurer doesn't have to write the extra $900,000 in insurance, and in fact, it's probably 9 other people who are writing the extra $900,000 of insurance. So while there are 9 extra people trying to buy a gas can, there are also 9 people with hoses standing right outside the house who are betting on kind of the opposite effect. So, you know, there are some sort of simple things to think about this question, simple ways of thinking about this question that are a little misleading. The next question is why you can't get insurance on Karma and me. I'm really happy you're not, because I think there are a lot of people who probably do want to kill me and would be, you know, interested in that insurance. But I think generally there's really no economic purpose to this insurance. Nobody really wants to know what the probability of me dying is. Whereas in the case of credit default swaps, there is a lot of economic information in the price of credit default swaps. And in general, what we have markets for is to provide information to all kinds of investors about all kinds of prospects for various firms. And the reason this market at least could potentially be socially beneficial is because it helps aggregate a lot of information about the creditworthiness of people and governments and entities that otherwise would not be there. So, for example, if there were no market like the credit default swap market in the current economy, it's possible that Greece would not be in trouble. Now the question is Greece being in trouble a good thing or a bad thing? My guess is if Greece was not in trouble now, they'd be in a lot worse trouble in a few years from now. And so one of the things these credit default swap markets do is they provide the information that force these contracts to come to a head sooner and prevent really big catastrophic things from happening by providing information in the financial market. Okay. And we can all agree that info in the market is good. There are economic theories that suggest that assets get overpriced when we don't let people sell them who have information that they really are overpriced. And that's basically what preventing the sale of credit default swaps would do. Having said that, is there a problem with the amount of credit default swaps that are out there? I think there potentially is a problem, and it's the same kind of problem as exists for basketball betting. You can think of credit default swaps as betting on whether firms are going to default or not. In basketball betting, suppose there's $2 trillion outstanding that is bet on the game between Toledo and Miami of Ohio. Now, we have a player from Miami of Ohio that can swing $2 million by missing a free throw at the end of the Toledo-Miami of Ohio game. And that's going to change the nature of that game. And that's kind of the problem with credit default swaps when the amount insured is grossly in excess of any reasonable economic consequence from the risk being insured. And so I think there is some room for regulation on the total amount of credit default swap open interest there is out there. I think there is, you know, it's important that counterparties to credit default swap contracts be solvent and be reputable and reduce counterparty risk. Part of this financial reform bill is to put to establish central clearinghouses for credit default swaps. I think that's a good thing. But I don't think credit default swaps were a big part of what was going on in this financial crisis. It's a small part of what was going on. It has some problems. We can improve on it. But a lot of the things people are saying are misleading at best.
You know, I have just a couple points to make. One argument in favor of the naked credit default swaps is that they promote price discovery, but the over-the-counter transactions are opaque rather than transparent, and so that hinders price discovery. I wouldn't ban naked credit default swaps, but in line with some of the comments that Ed was making, I think that they need to become more transparent and they have to have sort of proper clearing. So I would either by force of law or by incentives push as many as possible onto exchanges. And I also think that the other key issue is capital adequacy. So if they're not on exchanges and they're customized credit default swaps, that those institutions have to hold more capital. So we won't have AIG, an insurance fund that was running a hedge fund in its basement and issuing all these credit default swaps.
Great. It's an instrument of the free market, leading to the next question. How much faith should we put in the free market? Should we throw the baby out with the bathwater, start over? The issue at hand was several people and organizations were becoming extremely wealthy at the same time that they were sowing the seeds for a system-wide failure or crisis. Should this be allowed to happen? The sort of statement question is, doesn't the recent set of financial firm failures prove that the free market allows and encourages fraud, erroneous risk evaluation, and other crazy behavior because it is rewarded? Ed, do you want to start with that?
Okay. So, you know, my thinking about this question is probably the person who wrote the last question is kind of maybe the writer of this quiz, also a little angry at not only people with credit default swaps, but also the kind of investment banks or, I don't know, everybody who's ever traded a security. I guess I think the overwhelming amount of evidence is that it does not pay to misestimate risk. You know, it does not pay to engage in fraud. It does not pay to do any of these things in a free market. These things are generally not strongly supported by in free markets. Generally, you lose money by doing these things rather than gain money. But you have to recognize, if you're sort of a thinking, breathing individual, that free markets make errors. Prices are often wrong. In fact, every day they're wrong. That's why they change every day. So you have to live with the fact that these prices are wrong. If you're going to support free markets, nothing is infallible. One of the things about questions like this is I'm not sure what the alternative that's suggested is. Is the alternative, you know, government deciding on everything? Is the alternative, you know, let's find the smartest guy in the country to direct all the resources? I think over the years, in all kinds of economies, this has been proved to be a dismal failure. Just as an aside, one of the things I calculated, so for all the errors in the free market and all the destruction and bad things you can point to, I looked up the Standard & Poor's 500 when I started at the University of Washington, which is rumored to be 31 years ago. And the level of the Standard & Poor's 500 the day I started at the University of Chicago was 102. Now, after the come down from the highs of 2007-2008, Standard & Poor's 500 closed today at about 1159. This is a 1,000, or I think 1,000 is too low. I think it's a 10,000-fold increase, maybe a 1,000-fold increase. I don't know. I may have it wrong. But the average rate of return over that period on the Standard & Poor's 500, and this is ignoring dividends, is 8%. Now, who loses from all the shenanigans that people are claiming? The only people who lose are the people who are short-term traders. If you're a long-term trader and you held for the 31 years, you did fine. It's the people who are too smart to be long-term traders who have their wealth taken from them from people who are smarter than that. So I would encourage you to be a long-term investor. Then you don't have to worry about short-term shenanigans. And I have yet to see, you know, you look at any country in the world, you look at sort of across countries, countries with more free markets, less free markets, long-term performance, it is very clear that the reasonable alternatives we have destroy wealth relative to free markets. I should say, at this conference, a story was told that story goes like this. One of the attendees at the conference was being interviewed by the BBC. Now, I know a lot of people think the BBC is like the most wonderful news organization in the world. I personally think, I hate the BBC. I think the BBC is like a joke. They interview people when they think they already know the answer, and then they grade you on whether you gave the same answer they gave. And so I just, and often the answer is not my answer, so, you know, I guess I get a D. But this BBC person is interviewing somebody at the conference, and the first question is, now that we've determined that that capitalism doesn't work, what should we do next? And I guess I think the answer to that question this person gave was a good answer, which is, I think you determined capitalism didn't work when you were a sophomore in college, and you really haven't learned anything from it since then. And I guess I think I don't see any system that has performed better than the kind of system we have here. Obviously, the market shouldn't be totally free. Should be regulation. There should be controls. But generally, free markets are doing pretty good.
Well, there's a basic theorem in microeconomics that says perfect competition implies Pareto optimality. So what does that mean? It means that perfectly competitive markets allocate resources efficiently. But there are some conditions for this to hold. And one of them is near-perfect knowledge, transparency, information matters. And I think one of the things that happened in this financial crisis is that financial engineering made financial instruments ever more opaque so that it was hard to evaluate them. And I mean, to see an example, I mean, consider the life of a subprime loan. It starts out as a subprime loan. It's packaged with other subprime loans into a mortgage-backed security. The mortgage-backed security is packaged into a CDO. The CDO has several slices. The bottom floor, that's the worst slice. They'll absorb the losses first. They're rated triple B. The upper floors, they think the flood won't come through there because they get paid off first, so they're rated triple A. Then we got a CDO squared, so we take the bottom tranche and we divide that into a new tower.
Stop, you're depressing us all.
Well, I'm not done. And make some more triple B and triple A, and then what do we do when we run out of subprime loans? Well, we can make synthetic CDOs. So by the time this has happened, we say investors should do their due diligence. But they didn't, even the sophisticated investors. They found this too complicated, so they relied on the credit agencies, who didn't do the credit rating agencies such a great job, and plus the fact that they have perverse incentives because they are paid by the financial institutions that securitize these assets. And a basic assumption here was that housing prices wouldn't fall nationally, and it wasn't just the credit rating agencies that were saying this. The Fed chairman was also saying there hasn't, the former Fed chairman, a housing collapse in 70 years. So what happened is when housing prices did fall nationally, the whole edifice caved in. And financial institutions now that are holding these assets were capital deficient. So I think what this says is that we need some regulatory reform. I think financial institutions need to hold more capital, especially if they're too big to fail, or as Ed said, you know, at this conference, they were saying now it's too interconnected to fail, and that's what we saw in this crisis. So there are a few sort of creative ideas out there that I find appealing. One is an idea floating around that I think that Switzerland has actually done, is that financial institutions issue a new kind of convertible bond. And so what would happen is, in the event of a crisis, the regulator could actually force the financial institution to convert that bond into equity. And why is that good for you and me? It means that the creditors would bail out the financial institution, provide the needed capital, rather than us, the taxpayers. The rating agencies, well, I think they need to be reformed too, but I'm not sure what the reform should look like. There is an idea from two NYU professors that argue instead of the financial institution choosing the rating agency whom they pay for the rating, the SEC should choose the rating agency for them to try to get around those perverse incentives. And finally, I would say we need regulators to believe in the job they're doing. We need regulators to believe in regulation. And I think, unfortunately, our former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, and I've gone back and checked his memoirs, and what he said is, well, he didn't really believe in it, but he would rely on the other governors. But when Governor Gramlich suggested to him to look into the subprime loans, he looked the other way. So I think that was his biggest failure.
On to monetary policy. Karma being a specialist here, when the Fed's target for the nominal federal funds rate reached zero in December of 2008, they turned to non-traditional tools to achieve their goals, promoting maximum sustainability and maximum output and growth. Now, in implementing an exit strategy from this, which they'll have to do, when and perhaps how do you think that the Fed should raise its target on the federal funds rate? And if not now, why not? Why not, assuming that the the real GDP growth released on April 30th was above 3%. Irma?
So, first of all, a little bit about these non-traditional tools. What the Fed did in this crisis is what David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal calls whatever it takes. But they took on new patients and they administered new medicines besides lending to commercial banks. They started lending to investment banks. They started even lending to businesses like AT&T and GE by buying their commercial paper. Those programs have all expired now, however. And they pushed down their target for the federal funds rate, their traditional medicine, to zero. And then when they got it to zero and couldn't push it down any further, they started buying treasury bonds, as the European Central Bank is buying government bonds, and they started buying mortgage-backed securities and federal agency securities. And they still hold those. So they have to work on an exit strategy from them. Just to give you some idea of the numbers, and if you look at the data, before this crisis, reserves in the banking system were about $43 billion. Now they're over $1 trillion. However, only about $65 billion of them are required reserves. So the rest are all excess. They're sitting there idle on the balance sheets of banks, and the Fed is going to have to rein those in. But as far as its traditional policy, which is what the question really addresses, when should it start pushing up interest rates? Well, what the Fed says in its releases is that it'll keep interest rates low for an extended period. And so we all want to know, well, when's it going to push up interest rates? And I can't tell you it'll be on December 21st, 2010. But what I can tell you is some conditions under which they will start to push up interest rates. Right now, the economy is growing 3.2%, but that's relatively modest growth from such a severe downturn. Often we have a severe downturn, then we have a sharp recovery. So that's modest growth. The unemployment rate is 9.9%. The capacity utilization rate of the capital stock is 73%. So there's a lot of slack in the economy. That tends to keep down wages, to keep down prices, and productivity growth is high. So all that, I think, tells us that the Fed will keep rates low. And then, of course, there's the important core issue of inflation. Well, inflation is low right now. The Fed's preferred measure, which is called the Core Personal Consumption Expenditure Index, it's at the lowest rate since 1959. So there's a lot of slack. Inflation is low. Inflationary expectations look stable. So until these things change, I don't think we'll see the Fed pushing up interest rates.
Now, I don't have much to add to that, but I'll talk anyway. At this conference, one of the people I sat next to was a guy who runs the discount window for a regional Fed. So I don't know about you, but I have really no idea what he does on a day-to-day. You know, one of the questions I asked him was, well, how many times do people hit the discount window in like a year, like a typical year? Like, are you just sitting around most of the time by the window saying, anybody want a loan? Or? But anyway, what was interesting about this lunch is he then described to me all the ways that Fed policy had changed from roughly September 15th, 2008, when Lehman got into trouble, until today. And in that period, there was severe loosening and severe tightening of things that I never thought were Fed policy. So, you know, one of the things he said is, people don't go to the discount window partially because it's kind of a pain in the butt. They sort of ask you questions that you don't want to answer when you go to the discount window. Well, one of the things that happened is they stopped asking those questions when you went to the discount window to try to get loans back in late 2008. And all of a sudden, more people came to the discount window. So there are lots of things the Fed does that are really sort of implicit things that I think are... some of the things are sort of glaringly obvious that have changed. Some of the things are implicit that have changed. These sort of how much they question these loans has since 2009. Now they question the loans more than they did, let's say, March 2009. So, you know, the policies can weaken and loosen in ways that we don't necessarily directly see.
But we've already heard in question one some of your sentiment about taxing and spending. We've got a new health care bill. Ed, do you want to chew on that one? How do you think it's going to affect our economy and our health system?
Okay, so the new health care bill, there are several things about the new health care bill, most of which I find relatively troubling. One of them is it's very clear there's going to be I view the new health care bill kind of like the way I view health care in South Africa when the ANC took over South Africa. And one of the things the ANC said is we want a more egalitarian system. We want health care for all. And one of the prime things they said is we want all mothers to have access to prenatal child care free. Free prenatal child care for all pregnant women. And one of the things that happened is, everybody heard about this, there were pregnant women all over the place. There were more pregnant women than they even imagined they had. Now you go to the hospital and there's like lines of thousands of pregnant women who are looking for prenatal health care. This is kind of the way I view this package, if it works. If it works, there will be a huge increase in demand for health care. There is nothing that will increase the quantity supplied of health care. If anything, if you believe that these Medicare, you know, a lot of this health care package is funded by Medicare rollbacks that are probably never going to happen. But if they do happen, this is going to reduce the quantity supplied of health care. So, you know, if you took my course, let's see if I can do it backwards without a blackboard, but, you know, there's the quantity demanded over here, the quantity supplied over here, excess demand, and what happens in that case is something really weird. So there's going to be controlled something, you know, long waits. There's going to be maybe giving health care to your friends. There's going to be all kinds of problems with this. My guess is the most likely, and an increased fraction of GDP being devoted to health care. The ANC eventually had to renege on this promise for free prenatal health care to everybody. I think what's likely to happen is we go into a two-tier health care system where which is already happening now. To some extent, there are people who are going to pay the insured price, the government-insured price, for the government-insured quality of health care, which is going to be really low. And then there are going to be people who pay real money and get high-quality health care because that's the only way you're going to be able to get it. And any doctor who wants to make any money is going to have to go outside. If you're a high-quality enough doctor to get patients who are willing to pay you real money, you're going to leave the healthcare system. You're not going to get reimbursed by Medicare, Medicaid, or any insurance company, perhaps, and you're basically going to offer your own kind of fee-based healthcare, however you want to charge those fees. And I think the other thing about this bill is it increases taxes on capital. I think the evidence is that increasing taxes on capital is probably not very effective in raising money. Furthermore, it prevents, you know, we have a huge structural budget deficit right now. This increasing taxes on high wage earners is one of the ways potentially to solve the structural deficit. I think this sort of uses that up in the claim that it's revenue neutral. Well, it's revenue neutral if you never were going to tax those people anyway, but right now we have a huge budget commission that's trying to solve the long-term deficit problem, and this makes it more difficult for that. So I don't dislike everything in this health care bill. I think it's an effort to control adverse selection problems, an effort to get a lot of people insured who are getting health care expensively and inefficiently now, but I think it's kind of probably will reduce the overall quality of healthcare in the United States and probably will increase our economic difficulties.
Irma?
Well, I think there are issues of equity and efficiency. And despite all the things that I've said, I think it is a move toward greater equity to try to provide healthcare to the uninsured. There are also, on the other hand, problems of efficiency. Ed touched on sort of what we call in economics the labor-leisure choice. About half of the taxes are going to be levied on high-income households, and if that affects their willingness to work, then that leads to greater inefficiencies. On the other hand, there are some opportunities maybe for greater labor mobility here because insurance companies can't deny coverage now to people with pre-existing conditions that may free up people who are afraid to leave their job because of healthcare concerns to be more mobile. The Congressional Budget Office has said that this will be deficit neutral, meaning it won't have any effect on the deficit, as Ed mentioned, because half of it will be paid for from higher taxes, and the other half from cuts in Medicare, making Medicare more efficient. That's the tough part. They did set up a board to try to do that, but this board doesn't have any clout, and you know, as soon as somebody starts talking about looking at the effectiveness of different treatments and somebody says they're going to kill your grandmother, then sort of everything breaks down. So this part will be difficult.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Ed and Karma.